Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Pull the plug on Harper. Support Rabble today.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. And tonight we're going out of the studio. We're at the Center for Social Innovation Annex in downtown Toronto, and we have a live audience. So, say hi, everybody. Okay, so why are we here? We're here to celebrate 10 years of podcasting at Rabble.ca, and also to look at the trends in podcasting past and present. How do we get here, and where are we going? Well, in the fall of 2005, I got an email from Wayne McPhail, who is this guy right here, asking me if I'd be interested in doing a podcast for the Rabble Podcast Network. I'd heard of Rabble, because Rabble had been around a couple of years before that, but a podcast? Well, first, could you tell me, I asked him, Wayne, what is a podcast? So now, here we are 10 years later. I know what a podcast is, and so do a whole lot of other people. And the Rabble Podcast Network is now 10 years old. So, to set the stage a little bit, back when the Rabble Podcast Network first began, there was, believe it or not, no iTunes yet. There were no iPhones, and few people knew what a podcast was. Now, it's amazing because I get on buses and streetcars, and people are talking about podcasts that they're listening to, and I went, wow, finally. You know, after all of these years, people now know what a podcast is. And so some people actually say that we're in the golden age of podcasting. We at Rabble, we believe that podcasts are among the most democratic media genres to come along, well, since the internet itself. So today we're here to talk about podcasting and where we've been, where we're going, the broad themes of democracy, technology, and podcasting, and where we're heading. So first of all, joining us on our esteemed panel, I will have everyone introduce themselves, starting with Wayne, who I've already introduced, sort of.
I am Wayne McPhail, and I'm the Director of Emerging Media for Rabble.ca.
And I'm Nora Young. I'm the host and creator of Spark, and I am the host, along with my pal Kathy Bond, of the Sniffer Hobby Podcast, also celebrating its 10-year anniversary.
Yay. I'm Megan Perry. I'm the editor-in-chief at Rabble.ca, and I was formerly the executive producer of the podcast network.
Okay, and joining us from Winnipeg on Skype
is Rick Arp. And I hear myself a little bit, which is a little unsettling, but that's okay. I like the sound of my own voice. I'm based in Winnipeg. I'm the founder and editor-in-chief of MediaIndigena.com, which is an all-Indigenous online platform, which has recently moved from exclusively text-based production to exploring all sorts of audiovisual elements, including, of course, podcasting. I've got a background in radio as well, which I draw on, including community radio and CBC radio. I also did a little TV.
Okay, and that's our panel, and I'm your moderator, Victoria Fenner. I think I mentioned I'm the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network, and for the last year, and before that I've worked as a broadcaster in both CBC and also at community stations across the country and even a couple down in the U.S. So about the evening, for the first hour, we'll address a wide range of topics and then throw the floor open to you for your comments, your questions. And we also would like to recognize our sponsors for this evening, the Canadian Media Guild and Unifort Local 79M, and the M stands for media. So thank you to those sponsors, and thank you to Dave Mullenhaus and Kim Elliott, who helped us put this evening together as well. So I'd like to throw the microphone to Wayne. Well, not literally throw it, but anyway. I'm just wondering, okay, so way back in the days when podcasting started, it's like, where did this idea come from?
Well, back then, I was hearing podcasts and gadget podcasts. There were other ones And it's really, I think it's really important to remember that back in the early days of podcasting, podcasting was very much like ham radio was before the end of the Second World War in the U.S., which was a bunch of enthusiasts, mostly nerds, involved in a technology that most people didn't understand, but that was enormously valuable. And like what happened at the end of the Second World War, which is that the broadcast light or broadcast bandwidths, which were really valuable, got given over to RCA by the U.S. government. The podcasters were, or the ham radio operators were really innovative and doing some really neat stuff in terms of keeping people in touch with Antarctic works, science stations, all sorts of stuff. So in the early days, the stuff I was listening to were things like the Don and Drew show, which was a couple of people in a farmhouse just talking about their lives, and C.C. Chapman and folks like that. Dave Weiner was involved, and so was Adam Curry, who was a VJ on Much Music and then or on MTV, and then later moved into podcasting. So I was really captivated by the idea that ordinary schmoes in their basement with a microphone could actually do something that reached a whole bunch of people. And so it really struck me that there was an opportunity for Rabble to adopt that media, primarily because Rabble was born online. And that's really important to pay attention to, because a lot of mainstream media is sort of adopts online in a grudging, kind of grumpy way, because it's not their background. And there's still a lot of editors at newspapers and television and radio stations that kind of wish that the internet never caught on, right? And so Rabble was different, because it was actually, it was in its DNA to pay attention to emerging media. And so it really made sense to me to take this new technology, this new media, and bring it to Rabble and try to bring it to life.
Okay, and so then the next, Megan. So you've been involved with the Rabble Podcast Network for a lot of years. You're now our editor-in-chief as well.
Yes.
So did you see, like, what did you see in podcasting way back then? Like, when did you jump in and decide that you wanted to be part of it?
You know, I jumped in 2005, and I had just left the CBC to move to the Yukon. And when I left the CBC, I had come to CBC through community radio. And when I left CBC, I really thought that my radio career was over. I thought that was the end of it. I had gotten a job at a newspaper. I was like, I'm moving into print. And then I heard through, there was a call out on the National Campus Radio Association website, I think, from you, Wayne. And it was saying, we're starting this new network. We're looking for people. And I was so interested in that, because I just thought, this is an incredible new technology. I can do this from anywhere. And I can continue to work in audio. And I think also for me, I think that there, because I come out of community radio, I've always felt that there are a lot of voices that are underrepresented, and podcasting, because it offers so much space and leeway and is so accessible, offered a way to sort of have those voices heard. So that was kind of what appealed to me about it, and that's why I got involved. Which is, I got, you know, I emailed Wayne, I think I got a response back in about 3 seconds. It was very exciting.
So, and Rick joining us from Winnipeg. Now, I know Rick from community radio, from CKCU way back in, what year was that, Rick? I think 97, 98 or so. So can you tell us a bit about your business that you have launched?
Well, Media Indigenous just recently marked its fifth year anniversary, and in some ways its current fate is kind of reflective of a lot of independent projects like it. You know, roars out of the gate. I put every blood, sweat, and tear I can into it. A labor of love that doesn't pay a lot, and then I have to start to eat and things like that. I have to have a roof over my head, clothes on my back. Never mind those things for my family. So it's kind of slowed down, I guess is the nicest way to put it. And you find that that's a common pattern with podcasts in general, but certainly podcasts that are produced by people in sort of underrepresented communities. So Media Indigena is just an attempt to have an indigenous lens on indigenous issues, as opposed to having those issues seen through other people's eyes or expressed through other people's voices in the case of podcasting.
So has podcasting lived up to your hopes and dreams as far as providing a space where people can use accessible technology and get their voices out there and encourage the voices that we don't normally hear?
Well, I guess for me the operative word is it can. I mean, the seductive thing about the internet in general, and podcasting is included in this, is the costs of entry are, on the surface, minimal. I mean, you can just record yourself on Skype with a buddy and then put that out as your podcast if you wanted. You can just buy a half-decent microphone, plug it into your computer, and then ramble on for an hour and post that up and say, I'm podcasting. So basically you said, you know, can podcasting represent a promising alternative venue for people who belong to marginalized communities, let's say? And I think the operative word is it can. It can, but like much of the internet, it's very seductive, low cost of entry. But of course, the costs that are the greatest when it comes to producing something week in, week out, are one's time, are one's brain power, and after a while, I find myself focusing rather prosaically on revenue models as opposed to my content.
Nora, one of the reasons why I really wanted to hear from you is because podcasting, I think, is changing. We're seeing National Public Radio coming in now. We're seeing a lot of CBC people getting involved in podcasting. Some of that is like just reversioning of radio shows. But I'm wondering, when you first started podcasting with the Sniffer and you were at CBC, then what were CBC people saying about podcasting?
Yeah, so that goes back to 2005. And I was looking back and trying to do the math on this. CBC started experimenting with podcasts in 2005 as kind of pilot projects, but I couldn't quite figure out whether that was before the lockout or after the lockout. And I don't know if you remember this, 10, because it's a long time ago now, but so during the CBC lockout, Metro Morning in particular, Sheila Rogers with, I guess it was Sounds Like Canada at the time, started experimenting with doing podcasts. And it was really, it's an interesting moment because it's people who are used to having a platform and used to having a microphone who suddenly found themselves without a platform and without a microphone. And started doing this really, you know, hey kids, let's put on a show in the barn kind of thing. And I think that it was a really revelatory experience for a lot of people who, I won't say everybody, but a lot of CBCers, I think at that time, were very much inside the mainstream media bubble, right? And not really thinking about the world of social media and what opportunities it had to offer. And I think that was a moment where a lot of people realized, wow, blogging is fantastic and podcasting is fantastic. So there was a lot of this kind of excitement. And then CBC, I think, kind of went beyond the experimentation stage, which they were doing with, I think, Quirks and Quarks and a couple of other things, and started really getting on board with podcasting. And I'm pretty sure when Spark started in 2007, it was a podcast from the beginning. And, you know, it's funny, like, I remember at the time that Kathy and I started The Sniffer, we were both super optimistic / incredibly naive about it. Like, we really thought this, and I remember talking to you about this, Wayne, it's like, this is this new indie media revolution. And the reason why we started was because I had a summer series that didn't get picked up. And Kathy and I thought, hey, let's make this content on this thing called a podcast, and then we'll sell it to radio stations, and they'll put it on people's phones, which was like probably about 10 years before that was even a remotely viable revenue model or whatever. Anyway, so, but since then, we've obviously had a lot of fun doing this on our own. But I went back into the earlier years of my blog this afternoon to look at what I was saying about podcasting, and I found a blog post from May of 2005, which was commenting on the fact that Paris Hilton was doing a podcast to promote some movie that she was in. And I was saying, like, just wondering, is this the end of podcast stars who are within the podcasting world, people like Dawn and Drew, and the start of mainstream media getting involved? And of course, that's what happened. And so now I think we're at this kind of really interesting point where you have all these different players. And I don't know about your podcast selection, but in mine, I have like a lot of niche independent podcasts that are on topics that are of particular interest to me, but that probably wouldn't make it into, you know, broadcast. I have some public media things. I have some like Gimlet stuff that's, you know, independent, but still kind of better funded than the pure indies. So I think we're at this really interesting point now to see where it's going to go from here.
It's interesting what you're saying about the CBC sort of it being sort of a revelation, because I remember very clearly there was a conference, and it was like New Ideas in Sound or New Adventures in Sound or something, and it was a lot of folks who were documentary radio producers and making radio documentaries. And Charlotte Scott, who was the original producer of the Rabble Podcast Network way back then, and I went, and what we were hearing in the room were a lot of people standing up and bemoaning the fact that they couldn't get their documentaries on radio, that CBC was taking less documentaries, other radio stations even less than that, and it was they were really in sort of dire straits. And we thought, wow, this is really weird, because there's this thing called podcasting, and if we tell them about it, they will be all excited and love us, because we're giving them this fantastic way of getting their stuff out. And so we did just that, and it was crickets, because it wasn't an antenna. It wasn't broadcast radio. And so it was sort of like, instead of going to Doubleday to get your book done, you were running it off on a Gestetner in Mrs. Abernathy's class in, you know, in home room. And so it wasn't seen as a thing to do. Like, it was sort of slumming, right? Which was, I think, tragic. And doubly ironic when I hear the success of Serial, and I just sort of want to whack my head against a table and go back in time and say, you idiots, you know, look. So it's really interesting what happens when a media, whether it's newspapers or radio or sort of avant-garde radio documentary makers who are supposed to be countercultural to what radio is doing or, you know, supplementing it, come up against a medium they don't understand. And they just build barrier after barrier. And Charlotte and I had, frankly, a hell of a time early on trying to get any kind of traction around creating a podcast. It was just a real effort to get folks, and thank God we got some people like Nora and Kathy and others to actually pony up and do something, because I lost probably 3 mini-disc recorders to organizations that we were hoping would make use of them to produce podcasts. I never saw them again. But it's, you know, it's just fascinating to me how the a new medium just is not embraced by old media at all, you know, and it's very typical.
So Rick, I'd like to go to you now. Wayne was talking about the traction and not being able to get traction in the early days. What about the interest in podcasting in Indigenous communities?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, we're a smaller part of the population, so we're a fraction of the whatever percentage of the audience we assume exists now for podcasts in general, right? I still think, as much as we get all excited about podcasts, we're still a small percentage of the potential audience that watches other, that consumes other forms of media. So just as a minority population is a small percentage of the overall population, a minority listenership is the same situation. So there are technological barriers. Some people may have seen how up in north some of the broadband speeds are just atrocious relative to the population down south. So that can be a limitation. Remote communities don't necessarily have a robust infrastructure for internet connection. That said, there are some people doing some great stuff. I'm thinking of, in particular, as an example, Ryan McMahon has a fledgling podcast network. called Indian and Cowboy. I don't know if I should call it fledgling anymore. It's been around for almost a year now. And he's really sort of doubled down and tripled down, a real labor of love. But I'm thinking it's sort of chicken or egg, right? Why would you do a podcast for Indigenous people if no one's listening? But then why would Indigenous people get into listening to podcasts that might reflect them if nobody's doing stuff? So I still think we're kind of at that phase. But I also know with interest that, like a lot of podcasts in general, there's people who start them, and they're all raring to go, and they do five right out of the gate, and then all of a sudden you don't hear from them very often, and then maybe they'll scratch out 10. But after that 10th one, it's almost like 5 years in the restaurant business. If you can get, you know, if you can get past those benchmarks, you're on your way to doing something successful. But, you know, the internet demands frequency. It demands regularity and consistency. And if you're doing this on a part-time basis, then that's where it becomes challenging. And if you're a member of a marginalized community who's not making as much on the dollar as, you know, perhaps as a white straight male might, you know, you've got all these other challenges, right? So that's kind of a long, circuitous answer to your question, but that's sort of how I come at it.
I have to say, just on that note, Rick, about the tendency to pod fade, just as a totally practical thing, it can be helpful to work with a partner, because the chances of you both pod fading at the same time are not as great. So that's like, I would have quit 100 times probably if it hadn't been for, you know, podcasting with somebody else as well.
Well, that's really funny, because coming out of community radio, like Megan and I both come out of community radio, and it's like there are volunteers who do a show week after week after week. So Megan, what's that about? Why do we get pod fade in podcasting and we don't get it in radio?
Well, I think in radio, I think you are in a, you know, I mean, when I started podcasting, I was podcasting from the Yukon. As far as I know, I was the only podcaster in the Yukon. I was working with Rabble, so Wayne was my main contact. And I really did find it, being part of a community is very important. And I think that's actually been a strength at the network, because there have been a group of podcasts podcasting together. And that has kept some people, you know, we still do have people who pod fade, but they will come back into the network because there is that community. And I think community radio brings that. That's why you have devoted volunteers who come in week after week after week for 20 years and do their show. And I think that's one of the challenges with being a podcaster, is that you are working in isolation a lot of the time. And so it does become important to have a partner, or to have, you know, a network or producers that you're working with quite often that can help you kind of just keep your enthusiasm up and keep your creativity strong.
Yeah. Or somebody to leave a comment. Like, sometimes you really feel like nice. Nobody is listening. Like, that's
kind of like radio too, because it's like, I always say about radio, it's like, it's a kind of place where people go into soundproof booths and talk to imaginary people for hours at a time. So, but podcasting is like that in a way too, except you don't ever have to see anybody. Like at a community radio station, you have a production center that you come to. But anyway, this is a good time, Megan, to throw in a little bit an idea. Megan was the executive producer of the podcast network for a lot of years, just before I was. So do you want to say a couple of things about how the Rabble Podcast Network is structured and how people get shows?
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to tell one story, because this idea of people leaving a comment. I did a contest in the early days of Rabble Radio. I've been doing it for a few years, I think, and I did a contest where I was giving away an iPod. And I was like, write in, I'll do a draw. And I got one response. And I was so excited by that one response. And then I said, oh, great, okay, you win the iPod. I love you, by the way. And where do you want me to send it? And he said, Tokyo.
Oh, wow. That's a little expensive, eh?
It was, worth it to me. The emotional reward was great. But it just really made me realize that podcasting had such an enormous reach. Although people are maybe listening in silence a little bit, as a podcaster, you have a very wide reach that you might not have in radio. So now I can go back to your question. During my time, people would pitch to me. So Wayne would be doing outreach to organizations as well. And when I came in, there were already a number of podcasts on the network. So from that, then people would pitch their shows, and I would work with them to help them with production challenges and talk about software and that kind of thing, talk about recording, and basically train them to be posting their own podcasts, producing and posting.
So that's just a basic rundown. Do you have more you want to say about that?
No.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important in the early days of the Rabble Podcast Network, and it comes back to the discussion of working alone, is it's an old idea now, but at the time that we were putting the network together, there was a lot of discussion around the idea of the long tail. And that's this notion of organizations like Amazon, for example, that doesn't really have much of a cost of inventory, can have a lot of back catalog that doesn't sell very much, but if a bunch of them sell a little bit and it doesn't cost you very much to have a lot, then you actually can make money off of that long tail, maybe even more than if you can of the Margaret Atwoods of the world. And so when we set up the Rabble Podcast Network, one of the reasons that we did it as a network was that we could create that long tail, that we could create a body of podcasts, some of which, like Rabble Radio, was sort of the flagship show back then, that we would hope would get a lot of traffic, and then more niche players, podcasts, would maybe not get as much traffic, but because there were hopefully going to be a lot of them, and there ended up being a lot of them, that they would aggregate into an audience that was worthwhile, and there would be cross-pollination, that people say, oh, I'm listening to this, maybe I'll listen to that. So in the same way that the podcasters were working together, talking to one another, we wanted the audience to be together, and we wanted Rabble to be sort of the central point of podcasting and a podcasting audience in Canada, and that was really, really important to us, to have a variety of podcasts, even if they're really niche. And there was there's a great former publisher of the Ottawa Citizen, once said that niche work if you can get it, and that was exactly what we were trying to do, is get all those niches together in one place in Canada and give that diversity of voices a home where people could discover all these different voices in the podcast world.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to give credit where it's due with the RPN, because that's become a very popular strategy around, you know, you can think about things like Gimlet Media and stuff starting up now from former NPR people. And a lot of that has to do with discoverability and the problem of discoverability. And you know, you start to see these models where somebody who's doing a podcast will, like, give a little shout-out to somebody who's doing a podcast that seems like it would appeal to the same type of people as an effective way of making those kinds of recommendations. And that's something RPM was doing very early on, that idea of a network and the heightening discoverability.
This is one thing that I'm wondering about, Nora, is how you think that podcasting has changed since the bigger players have come into it. Is podcasting the same as it was in 2005?
Well, no. You know, it's interesting because we can see where the trend is going, but the reality for most mainstream media podcasts is that they're on-demand versions of radio shows. And that's starting to change. I mean, CBC just launched Campus, its first natively podcast show, but it's still the case that the over-the-air radio audience is generally much larger than the podcast audience, although, as I say, that's changing. So I think what it'll be interesting to see is how, as that starts to shift and more people get into the digital on-demand side, how is that going to change the aesthetic, right? Because one thing that I think that it's different between, say, what I do with Spark and what I do with Sniffer is that, you know, Spark there's a sense in which it's quite broadcasty, right? It still has a lot of those aesthetic ideas. Like, you, when you write for radio, you write so that somebody who walks out of the room and comes back in and turns on the blender can still follow the thread of what's going on, right? Or somebody who's driving can still follow the thread of what's going on. But if you're doing a podcast, you don't have to worry about that because the person could just, oh, I missed that, I'm just going to rewind, right? So I think that that'll be kind of interesting to see if we get to the point where the on-demand podcast form becomes the dominant form for public media. Does that then say, okay, now we have to change the aesthetic of what we do to reflect the heightened intimacy, you know, the fact that people are usually listening on headphones and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, is podcasting really, really about reaching huge numbers of ears? That's not the way it started. Wayne, do you have any thoughts on that?
And no, it's not. It's meant to be, as I was saying before, it's very much of a niche product. That the people who listen to specific podcasts do it because they love the nerd thing that they're listening to, whether it's, you know, drying fruit or, you know, recycling heat pumps or whatever it is that they're interested in. They'll listen to the Daily Heat Pump podcast, right? Because they are passionate about that. And you don't listen to a podcast about it, something you're not interested in. So just because only 100 people listen to, you know, neurosurgery today doesn't mean that that audience is insignificant. It means that you've got a very specific audience that you can reach. And from an advertising point of view and from a sponsorship point of view, they're very important. That's why, for example, a ton of podcasts in the U.S. and Canada are sponsored by Audible. Like, no kidding. It's people who have earphones in and are listening to people talk. Gee, that sounds like our audience, right? So, of course, they're going to advertise. Or people who are passionate about nerd things. So if you listen to, say, Daring Fireball, which is a John Gruber podcast with the guy who is passionate about Apple and typography and brands, and you have a company that is obsessive about eyewear, like Warby Parker, or about shaving, like Harry's, of course they're going to advertise because they're going after the OCD crowd. Right? And so it's natural that they're going to advertise in a podcast where people care about nerdy details about typography and Apple products, right? So it's really important to get those niches.
Well, I mean, that's, I think that I'll bring Rick in here too. I'm going to ask everybody the same question here. I'm wondering, is radio and podcasting, in what ways are they the same and not the same? This is what always, coming from a radio background, I bring my radio aesthetic to podcasting, but not everybody does that. Some people say, no, podcasting is not radio. We say on Rabble, we're radio-free radio. Okay, so Rick, what do you think? What is the difference and similarity between podcasting and radio? Are the two the same?
Well, you know, one thought that came to my mind listening to everyone contribute their different pieces of the puzzle here is that, you know, podcasting has been sort of lauded before as the next big thing, and it seems to go in this kind of Ferris wheel cycle, and we kind of go back into its period. And some have said this is just the latest in the cycle. I still think we're building podcasting as a medium while at the same time building an audience. Like, the two are inextricably connected. And I guess I find myself more consumed with questions about the viability of a given podcast in terms of the ability of the producer to be able to afford to continue to do it rather than sort of doing it as a labor of love. And I think that podcasting, although it's, you know, increasing every year, I think in terms of potential audience relative to radio, I still think it has a long way to go. But in terms of, if you're talking about the approach to it and sort of creating soundscapes, I mean, I think it can be, but I think there's more latitude to try many, many different approaches to it. And as we've heard many times, you can afford to go deep in a niche. And if there are other people, other people out there who fly the same freak flag as you, then you're going to have this great kismet.
Although maybe not as many listeners as you might have if you were actually on the air. But anyway, what do you think, Megan? Radio and podcasting, what's a different similarity? Are they the same?
Well, I really think they're very, very different. I just think that the options available to podcast producers for what they can say, what they can produce, the music they can use, the people they talk to, the places they go, are much broader just because of the amount of space that is available to them when they go to play their podcast. You know, that was one of the things that really shocked me when I started producing Rabble Radio, was that because of the way the technology was, the sound quality was lower than it had been when I was in public radio. But people were listening for content, and there were podcasts. I remember I recorded a podcast that I hosted in the car driving between Whitehorse and Dawson City, so it sounded really rough. And I think that wouldn't have aired on radio. It certainly wouldn't have aired on radio. But at Rabble, it became extremely popular. And I think it was just because it had that immediacy. So I think that's something that podcasting has that maybe hasn't really reached into public radio yet, and I think, like Nora was saying, it may, as podcasting becomes a more dominant format, that sort of sound use may change. But I think there's also there are some podcasts that are extremely dominant, like This American Life is an extremely dominant podcast, and I think in the same way that other media is consumed, there's a mainstream that is definitely very strong. I think that podcasting may end up in the same way. So I think the challenge for podcasters is to keep pushing the envelope, and for the niche podcasters to keep doing that despite the pressure to kind of come into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you're talking about the rawness of some podcasts. I confront this every week when I'm working for Rabble, is there'll be people who want to do a podcast and they'll send me a sample episode, and I'll go, okay, do we send this back to the drawing board for a few more go-rounds? I come out of community radio where I have heard really, really brilliantly conceived programs just not work very well at all because of the technical abilities, for example, and the production. And so I'm always struggling with, do I really, really want to make this into something which is worthy of a public radio station, or is that standard? You know, is it destroying the whole idea that anyone can do this, and so we don't want to push for this standard of perfection? So I'm really torn on that. And so, but Nora, what would you say the differences between podcasting and radio shows, and is there a difference?
Well, I mean, I think just to your point about the professionalism or whatever, I think that the one thing I really value about podcasts is there's a level of intimacy and direct connection, which is usually kind of heightened by the fact that you're not listening to it because you're in the car or because you're making dinner. You're listening to it because you're thinking, I chose to subscribe to this thing, and now is the time when I really want to listen to this one thing. Like, that's an incredible connection that the podcaster and the person in the audience have that you don't actually get in radio. And I think that should be respected, and the opportunities that affords you to have really intimate conversations is really important. And that, I think, implies a different kind of aesthetic. Having said that, some of my favorite podcasts, most of the podcasts I listen to, are very nichey. And there's one I listen to in particular, and the content is great, but it takes him so long to get to the point. And that, like, one thing that I think actually would be a really great thing to bring to podcasts is some of the discipline of time. Like, there's something about, you know, like, at Spark, every episode is normally, when we first start to mix it, it's an hour and a half long or something, right? And then you have to cut it down. And there's a virtue in having to stick to time and keep focused. So I feel a little bit of two minds about that. But then, you know, I mean, I think there's always going to be this fundamental difference where, at one level, it's radio on demand that's not going over the airwaves. And on the other hand, it's this very intimate medium, podcasting.
Okay, so Wayne, your turn to weigh in on this.
I think one of the ways to think about or to look at how podcasting these days is different from radio is to look at what happens to podcast listening when somebody who listens to podcasts designs a podcast player. And so if you look at what Marco Armit did with the Overdrive player, which is a Overcast player, which is a player for the iPhone. What that allows you to do is, and Nora alluded to this notion of time, is it allows you to basically kind of lift a podcast out of time, which is, I think, one of the big differentiators between broadcast radio and podcasts, is that podcasts are much lifted out of time. And early on, you would hear people say, if you didn't hear this in the last episode, look, I'm just going to stop, go back, listen to the previous episode. Done? Good. Okay, keep going. Here we go. Right? Or they'll say, hey, we've got an ad coming. If you don't want to listen to the ad, that's okay. Just skip past it. Right? Which just divorces it from a linear timeline, which you can't do in broadcast radio, at least not until you turn it into a podcast. So if you look at Marco Armit's podcast player, what he does is he has buttons on the podcast player that allow you to skip ahead 30 seconds, skip back 30 seconds. It has built-in silence removal, so that if somebody pauses for a while in a podcast, it compresses it. So you actually end up listening to a podcast in about 95% of the time that you would listen to a longer podcast. Stuff like that is somebody who actually understands how podcasts work and are trying to sort of beat against this idea of taking so long to get to a point like I am right now. And so that, it's to me, that's fascinating, that it's somebody who gets what podcasts are about, including the intimacy, because the other thing that Marco's player does is boosts the voice, so that if you are listening in the kitchen, you got a blender running and you've got it on an iPhone, you can actually, without a speaker, hear it pretty well because of the voice boost that he's built into the player. So it's really interesting to see where you go when you're freed from the constraints of broadcast and you're thinking about the medium itself.
One of the things that we have lacked in podcasting is, if we had had an app like YouTube, for example, where it was so easy just to upload something and have people listen to it, then I think podcasting might have taken off a lot faster than it did. The iTunes interface is just like, it's horrible to find your way around. In the early days, it was anyway. It still hasn't improved all that much, but I'm just thinking of, you were talking about the apps which are specifically made for podcasting, and it's like, that's one of the things that I have wished. The Gimlet Media people, in a wonderful, wonderful podcast called Startup, they did their first year on starting up a podcast and media and audio production company for the internet. And he went around and he shopped around to find investors. And a lot of those investors said, oh, okay, well, let's build an app for it first. And he was going, no, I don't want to build an app. I want to do programming. And they're saying, no, but you need an app. It's not going to get out there if you don't have the right app for it. And I think that's one thing that we've really been missing. Any comments on that? Or?
Well, I mean, part of the problem with the penetration of podcasts, and particularly when we're talking a lot about podcasts here on the Rabble Podcast Network, and it's individuals or small organizations doing podcasts, although obviously CBC, NBC, NPR are doing them as well. And in big scale, that it's important to keep in mind that part of the reason why podcasting doesn't have as much penetration as it does is because, for example, on the Android platform, there isn't a good podcast player. And a lot of people are listening to audio on their phones, and if they don't have an easy way of getting it on their phones, they're not going to do it. And so that's been a limitation of not having easy-to-use players that people can actually subscribe to simply and get it on. A lot of people still listen on their desktops or still listen through iTunes, you know, hellacious iTunes, and download it onto their podcast player.
So I'm not the only person who thinks that iTunes is hellacious then. That's good. I thought I was in the minority because everybody's been saying, oh, iTunes is so wonderful. And I'm going, what? Do we have the same iTunes? But yeah, the whole idea of technological change is something that now it's like more people are listening on mobile, and so that's what we're looking at with Rabble also is everything now is listened to through the Rabble site. Does that need to change as listener patterns are starting to change? So anybody else want to chime in on that?
People's relationship with their phones has changed a lot of things. I mean, I know for myself, I felt like over the course of the years, the number of people who will say, oh, I love the podcast, meaning Spark, they don't reference CBC, they don't reference the radio, they just talk about the podcast. Anecdotally, it's been increasing, but I think the fact that people have developed this comfort level with downloading apps and getting content on their phones has made a big difference and will make a big difference in terms of the adoption of podcasts.
So now, we are now heading into the home stretch. I want to be able to open up the floor to the rest of you for comments in just a second. So, but right now, can we just vision ahead? It's now the 10th anniversary of the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that is a triumphant, you know, place to be. So now, of all of you, first of all, start with you, Rick. What can you see that that the Rabble Podcast Network could be doing that we don't do already?
Well, I think you just touched upon it there. I think Rabble has to make inroads into places like Stitcher, which I'm surprised. I don't know if anyone mentioned it and Skype cut out, but to me that really is the YouTube of podcasts. It's an app available on both iPhones and the Android platforms, and it is somewhat searchable. They do make recommendations, so that discoverability that Nora references is they are making strides to do that. They're also building interconnectivity with in-dash. What am I looking for here? Basically, they've done a deal with different car companies, including Volkswagen, where basically your podcast can effortlessly stream into your car radio, which I think is also, you know, another area where many people consume audio only for obvious reasons. So I think Rabble has to move away from just a pure desktop experience and get into those realms, frankly.
Okay, thanks. And how about you, Megan? Where would you like to see Rabble going with our podcasts in the next 10 years? Is a long time.
It's a long time
in the era of technological change. So even the next couple of years.
Yeah, we did this at the Rabble. We had a retreat, and we were talking about where will Rabble be in 10 years. And it was, you know, there's been so much advancement in the last 10 years that it's very difficult to think forward that far. But I do think that, you know, in the next 10 years, the style of podcast has changed. I think that our ability to refer back and forth within the network and to build that community within the network, I think as communication between podcasters improves. And, you know, when we first started, we had a listserv. You know, there are a million other ways for us to get in touch with each other now and to share audio back and forth. So, you know, I expect that there'll be more and more of that. And, yeah, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see that community grow so that we can support those niche pieces of it that are liable to get lost in the mainstream.
Nora?
Yeah, I think Rick and Megan both make excellent points. I mean, as a general observation about where podcasts are likely to go, I think we're probably going to start to see more multimedia content. I think there's always going to be a role for pure audio just because it makes multitasking so easy, but I think there's going to be a role for more multimedia, and I think we're going to start to see things like, you know, actually, we're just doing a thing on the show this week about this, about the improvements in speech recognition. So I think we're going to start to see a lot more automatic transcription of things. Because the big challenge for all audio is in audio tends not to go viral, right? So there's going to be kind of a push towards both of those, I think. But, yeah.
Okay, and Wayne?
I think you could see a little bit of where things might go from yesterday's keynote, what Apple was showing with voice recognition and Siri and the Apple TV. And combined with that, I've been thinking a lot about, because I've had an Apple Watch for a few weeks now, and it's a fascinating device. If you combine the interface of a wearable like an Apple Watch with Bluetooth headphones and a podcast network and voice recognition, it becomes very easy to say, could we go back 15 seconds? I really like this podcast. Can I hear another one like this? And have those playlists be built through AI recognition of what you actually have listened to and want to listen to. And I think that that's going to be really appealing and is sort of the next stage of mobile, is this sort of invisible, ambient computing that's close to your skin and in your head in a sense of understanding what you want to do.
Okay, so I'm just going to approach that just one more time before we throw the floor open. But what about specifically related to Rabble's mandate and media democracy, marginalized voices, getting voices out there that aren't being heard already? Mm-hmm. What should we be doing in the next 10 years? And I'm going to throw back. Okay, so Rick, we'll go to you first, and we'll go back across the table the other way.
Perhaps to the extent that it's possible, get the physical equipment out to the communities that need them. You know, this is becoming... I do a lot of my stuff all through my smartphone, so if you can get smartphones out into the communities, that's the hardware, but I guess the soft work, too, of training people on that. And then maybe, you know, this is the eternal struggle, trying to get some... help people make a living at this, as opposed to relying on either repurposing something in a second window or doing it as a volunteer effort.
Okay. Wait.
I think the training piece is really important. You know, I do some training for unions in Canada about making use of smartphones to cover rallies and other kinds of events. And it's really interesting to hear people talk about their past experience where they've said, you know, we need to buy $30,000 worth of television equipment and have a studio to do this. And that does not increase one iota your scalability, your capacity to do this. It just increases your ability to spend money really quickly. And so I think that a lot of people, as you mentioned, Rick, with smartphones, have everything they need to do really interesting multimedia coverage of their communities and get their voices out. What they don't know how to do is use it. And so I think there's a real opportunity for Rabble to, and I know we've been trying in terms of grants and stuff, to get into communities and just do one-day workshops, two-day workshops to say, here's how to get good sound, here's how to get good lighting, here's how to cut an edit on your smartphone something that actually looks half decent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what your current relationship is with people that you're trying to get to do podcasts, but one thing I would say is I think that thinking about the user experience from a UX point of view, thinking about not... Like, often the people who are on the technical side and explaining the stuff are kind of over-engineering stuff for people, right? I would say, like, giving people the simplest, most user-friendly tools to make what they are making and not overly... not you don't need to make the learning curve that steep. And I think the other thing is, I mean, I absolutely agree with Rick that it's a big ask to ask somebody to do that when, you know, they've got... they're working two jobs or whatever it is that they're, you know, that's going on in their lives. It's a big ask. So even helping to defray the cost a little bit is, I think, would be huge.
And Megan?
I mean, I think for Rabble, I think one of the things that we have been able to offer and, you know, I hope we'll continue to offer is kind of this, there's sort of a sense of what you produce has to be a certain quality and of a certain set of topics. I think one of the things that Rabble is great at doing is asking people to report on things that maybe are not being reported. And sometimes that makes it a little bit more accessible. You know, if you're reporting from a community that's not well represented, to be able to tell the story in the way that you want to tell it about an issue that is important within the community is actually quite empowering to people. So if you can combine that with making the technology simple enough for people to kind of use, then it's easier to kind of locate that person or two people in a community that really want to be working on the paper, they really want to be reporting, they want to be telling the stories that are important for them. So I think that's something that Rabble can really offer, you know, in tandem with the training and the technology getting easier. I think just the space for those voices.
Okay, well, I'd like to throw the floor open to the rest of you in just a second. I'm just going to wrap up the formal part. And so we just wanted to say thank you to all of our panelists, Megan Perry, Nora Young, and Wayne McPhail, and Rick Harp from Winnipeg on Skype. And we also have sponsors to thank, Unifor79M, M standing for Media, and also the Canadian Media Guild. And also big thank yous to Dave Mullenhaus and Kim Elliott for organizing this shindig with me, and to the rest of the Rabble staff for all of their help as we put this together. And especially thanks to all of our podcasters, both current ones and over the years, for the wonderful and diligent job you do putting together your podcast, because without you, we would not be the Rabble Podcast Network. So just want to know right now, is there anyone in the audience who is a current Rabble podcaster who I haven't met, because I don't see your faces? Is there anyone here who wants to be a Rabble podcaster? Okay, we have a few people. Anyway, if you do want to, I'd be happy to talk to you after we're done here. Judy Rebick is also in the audience here too, and Judy was instrumental in getting both Rabble and the Rabble Podcast Network together. So I wanted to do a big shout out to you to say thank you for your forward thinking. Okay. What I would like to do is keep the discussion going for about 20 minutes or so. If anyone has a comment, please come up to the front. You'll have to speak in the microphone, otherwise it won't be recorded. Okay?
I think what's also really important is to support campus radio stations as well, because you don't have to listen to the stupid commercials that some of the other stations. CBC is better, but there's still problems I find with CBC as well. But I think shows like Democracy Now!, The Real News, I think those are really important to support as well, because you'll get alternatives. And I don't know. CBC is still a public broadcaster, because I think it's probably a crown corporation. But at the same time, I think it's still really important to support alternative media.
Do you do a show yourself?
No, I don't.
Okay, but what station do you support?
CIUT. I usually listen to Democracy Now! Sometimes when I'm on the computer, I'll go to The Real News. I'll kind of, surf different events, Al Jazeera English.
Yeah, and I do. We have a lot of people who are from campus and community radio, and we do actually rebroadcast some shows from campus community radio. So we are really, really happy to have that partnership going. So anybody else?
I did community radio for 22 years, 10 of it in management as a production manager for Ryerson Radio, about CKLN, back in its heyday before it imploded. But what I find a bit disturbing about how you were talking about podcasts was its constant comparison to radio in its quality. You want this to sound like professionally produced radio. Podcast is a democratic, non-funded, generally amateur idea. And that's the beauty of podcasts, is it allows this woman here to sit in her bedroom and do a radio show and not have to worry about the production values that add up to the CBC, with compression that makes everything boom at the right point, with specific theme music that is written for the show that doesn't have to fight copyright laws and all this sort of thing. And I find it disturbing that you want to move away from this rawness, which is what the podcast is about, which chat groups were originally about, was about this rawness, about this lack of production value that didn't make it feel like radio. Instead, we're taking podcasts and seeing them as, and constantly, subconsciously comparing them to radio. And I think that I find problematic. And also, like when you were talking about this app that came up that took away spaces within voices, that took away from what was actually happening in that recording, which is what this person put in it in the first place. So again, we're moving it into radio, which podcasting, in a sense, was anti-radio. Doing radio that was anti-radio, which was originally what college and campus radio stations were about. Then they became radio.
I just wondered if you could comment on the implications for democracy when you're speaking about small communities or marginalized communities talking to small or marginalized communities. We've talked about niche markets and narrow focus. And I wonder if we're distinguishing podcasts from mass media, if there are positive or negative implications for democracy when you're talking about small communities, perhaps in numbers, or marginalized communities speaking directly to those communities.
I think that that's, it's both a blessing and a curse. I think that it's for marginalized communities or smaller communities to be able to tell their own stories is extremely important, and I think that it gives people a chance to comment publicly in a way that maybe that they couldn't be doing in the mainstream media. On the other hand, sometimes those podcasts, because they are niche podcasts, the message may not be flowing outward. But it's always my hope that producing that kind of material will both will share that message to a broader audience. So that's kind of what I do think that has implications for media democracy, certainly, and being able to kind of produce more. I think that the volume is important. I think if there's only one or two stories being told from smaller communities, that they are less likely to be picked up and those ideas are less likely to be shared. So I think volume is very important, and that's an option that podcasting presents in that way. Does that answer your question?
This question has been posed and touched on in various ways, but I'd like to pose it directly. How big is the audience for podcasts, and what kinds of people are in that audience?
Wayne, do you want to take that?
There was a sort of interesting survey done not too long ago. About one-fifth of the U.S. population in some form or another listens to a podcast, and there's about 86,000 podcasts that are active, give or take. So it's not a huge number, but it is a growing number in terms of audience and in terms of active podcasts. It's almost starting in the last couple of years, sort of hockey sticking in terms of the number of new podcasts that have started up. Hockey stick even more if you look at just the podcasts that started up and died within the first 6 months. But there's tons of room for growth there. And I just wanted to come back to one quick point about the eliminating the sound. I agree with you that it, from an aesthetic point of view, it's a pain in the ass. The intention of it is, and not everybody does this, but there are people I know who will listen to podcasts at double speed, right? You can, so they can get through a bunch of podcasts really quickly. And eliminating the silences is just another way of speeding it up. So it's that's what I meant by addressing the what a podcast is, that people sometimes just want it. Information value. They're not listening to This American Life, they're listening to Heat Pumps Today, right? And they want to get all the heat pump information they can in their head as quickly as possible.
The artist in me goes, what would Beethoven say if someone came through and said, I'm going to take out all the rests? Scary.
Hello. So going sort of back to the discussion about apps and having a good app to access podcasts through, I think of a lot of publishing platforms, which over the past decade have sort of become less publishing platforms and more social media. So Instagram, YouTube, even to an extent, blogging sites like Tumblr used to be primarily about publishing things, and now they've evolved into social networks of sorts. So I want to get your take on whether you think podcasts have a chance to have a similar evolution. And if so, does this sort of mean that eventually, if they do sort of become a social network kind of thing, it's whoever hears them is going to be, it's basically going to be a competition of whoever can yell the loudest and get the most followers in order for them to get traction in the future?
Actually, if you look at the early days of podcasting, it was a social network. If you look at shows like Keith and the Girl, Don and Drew Show, Adam Curry, Daily Source Code, one of the things that differentiated it from radio was the incredible feedback that they wanted from the audience, and the to the point of including phone calls from the audience in the podcast and talking to other podcasters. So it's less social now than it used to be. So it's not an evolution towards that. It's actually sort of come, that's been taken away from podcasting over time, which is, I think, unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm Judy. So I had very little to do with the Rabble Podcast Network. My main contribution was I didn't stop Wayne from doing it. Because in the early days of Rabble, everybody wanted us to go to print, right? Like, because people didn't really appreciate. Don't forget, Rabble was founded in 2001, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the internet, there was no social media at all. Except us, really. And what was that horrible site in the States? I can't remember. Anyway, there was one other site in the States. And so people didn't appreciate the power, but they realized Rabble was a good thing, so then they wanted us to print a newspaper. And you were talking about the retreat, and I remember the retreat where we discussed that, and Wayne made the argument that, no, we need to go to multimedia, we need to stay online, and then proposed the podcast network. No, none of us had ever heard of podcasts. But this idea, I like this idea, so I just wanted to ask again. Because, for example, one of the problems in politics, since Rabble's a political site, is the thinness of political discussion, for example, even on CBC Radio. I mean, it's better on The Current and As It Happens than in most places. But certainly, in most places, it's very thin, it's very partisan, it's very narrow, right? So, like, using an more interactive, more social media type podcast, is that possible? Like, to sort of, I mean, I know Canada Land is trying to do it in a way, but in a particular kind of way, like more like, I don't know, like, anyway, I won't get into that. But less sensational, but trying to bring up the level of discussion, is that something that could happen with podcasting and have people contribute to that? Like, you have guests and then you'd have people call in and all that, and you can do that. Like, you were talking about using phones more, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something you could do with phones, and it wouldn't be like a call-in show, but you'd actually try and raise the level of discussion, partially like a call-in show. Like, I don't know if anybody heard the last two discussions on refugees, the call-ins, on both on Cross Country Checkup and on the Ontario call-in show, and they were fabulous, and it was just ordinary people calling in with experience in relation to Syria and refugees, and they were fantastic discussions, way better than any of the professional discussions. So I just wonder if podcasting could be used more in that way.
There's some interesting hybrids that are happening right now with not just podcasting, but also with visual as well. And Wayne and Megan, and we have some interesting things coming up with using Google Hangouts. Do you want to talk about the Google Hangouts election thing? Because even though there's going to be pictures with it, it's still the same kind of thing, bringing a lot of voices together.
Yeah, for those of you who aren't familiar with Google Hangouts, it's a free way that Google makes available for having up to 10 people in a video chat, and we're going to be bringing people across Canada together to discuss the environment and energy, and make that a live broadcast as well as a recorded one, and people will be able to join in by asking questions, and those questions will be moderated. But it's entirely possible to create a broader discussion using a tool like that. So I really like the idea a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we had a space for a while, the Commons, which was a video chat room, and people were using that for events and things like that. And sometimes on Babbel, we have Q&As, which could easily be podcast as well, you know, people phone in. So that's a great idea.
It's interesting that there are a lot more off-the-shelf kinds of tools starting to become available for doing that kind of thing and for doing something live in particular. Although the other side of it is that there is that, I still have that feeling that it is this very intimate relationship between the podcaster and the person who's listening, right? Mm-hmm. It somehow feels less like a community in certain ways. I don't know. Maybe that's just the way I use podcasts. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's also the challenge of getting people to call in that we were talking about earlier. That might be a challenge as well for audio. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think it has been a really, really great discussion. It's given me a lot of ideas of directions to go. I want to go out and hire an app developer to get a special new app that's Rabble-specific that people can put on their phones now. That's one of the things I want to do. One of the other things I want to do, too, is encourage all of you, if you think you would like to do a podcast or if you already do one and you would like to have it considered, it's very, very easy to get a podcast on the Rabble Podcast Network, provided that it's in line with our mandate and our mission statement, which is what, Megan?
Oh, I can't just rattle it off. Okay. News for the rest of us.
News for the rest of us, yes. So anyway, I would love to hear from any of you who would like to do a podcast. My email is very easy. It's victoria@rabble.ca. And I'm here to help you get it on the air. I can talk to you about just what it's all involved. And so please, don't be a stranger. And or if you have a radio show that you're doing already and you'd like to reversion it into a podcast, we're good with that too. So I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. And thank you for celebrating 10 years of Rabble with us, with the Rabble Podcast Network. I think it was a tremendous achievement for this group of intrepid, you know, visionaries, Wayne or Augenary, I guess is what the audio version would be, right? But I'm just absolutely amazed at what I'm involved with and the whole idea that this has just, you know, for 10 years we've been there, we led the pack, and I say, yay, Rabble. So, and like to thank Rick, who has this been a strange experience, Rick being on Skype and being part of this?
100%.
That's what I thought. It's the disembodied voice. This is what audio is, you know? So anyway, Wayne McPhail, thank you very much. Nora Young, thank you very much. Megan Perry, thank you very much.
You.
And I would also like to thank Dave and our associate producer, and Kim, our publisher, the rest of Rabble staff for helping support this through promotion, through all kinds of things. Our sponsors again, Unifor, Local 79M for Media, and Canadian Media Guild, and also to the staff here at the Center for Social Innovation. And thank you for coming. This has been Needs No Introduction.